You're listening to Tempest in a Stockpot. I'm Christine Bruce.
And I'm Brenda Barrett.
And together we're agitating for change in Northern BC. In this episode, which we've entitled Challenging the Charity Model, Jordan Baltitude of Gordon Neighborhood House in Vancouver returns to walk us through the many inequities of the charity model that we've grown accustomed to following. In her role as Food Justice and Poverty Reduction Analyst, Jordan partners with an organization called Right to Food, who are in the process of lobbying the federal government to implement a Universal Basic Income, or UBI, across the country. A UBI would bring equity back into the realm of food security. Time to check the pot and see what's cooking. Northern BC is comfortably located within the boreal forest, a biome characterized by mostly coniferous trees with long cold winters and short summers. The boreal forest covers the northern parts of North America, Europe, and Asia, but the most significant portion rests in Canada. The world's largest land biome, the boreal is crucial for global climate regulation, carbon storage, and water purification. It's home to diverse wildlife and bird species. And if you're thinking in economic terms, it's crucial for resources like timber, minerals, and hydroelectric power. As Canadians, we can get a little glib about resource extraction, and we forget the forest's immeasurable value, particularly in a time of climate emergencies. My grandkids and I tend to see trees through the eyes of writers like Shel Silverstein. Trees are living creatures whose first thought is to give back, and they're exceptionally generous. Silverstein's story, The Giving Tree, is mythical in tone, but it's based in fact. Trees release oxygen and correct bad air quality. They keep us cool, and if you've ever sat under a tree, you'll have felt comforted and relaxed. Their roots fix the land in place, and they keep the soil properly mineralized. The boreal forest is home to so many of these giving creatures, and just like our careless attitude towards forests, we can sometimes take food for granted. It will always be there, right? Until it's not, and then we're in a world of trouble.
Hi, I'm Jordan. I'm the Food Justice and Poverty Reduction Analyst at Gordon Neighborhood House, which is a community-focused organization in the west end of Vancouver. Through my role there, I also coordinate the BC Regional Advocacy Network with Right to Food. I've been working with Gordon House for just over 4 years, and we've been partnered with Right to Food for just over two. Right to Food is a national organization that focuses on addressing food insecurity in Canada, and they do that in three key ways. The first is by co-creating and supporting community food centers, which are places where people can grow and cook, share and advocate for good food in environments that are rooted in dignity and belonging. The second is that they strengthen the food sector ecosystem by offering training and program models and knowledge sharing and funding so that community organizations can focus on frontline work and spend less time on that admin piece. And then the third is that they drive policy change at the national level through campaigns and local action and policy tools and training. And they work with more than 450 organizations across the country to move the needle on advancing the right to food. So my role kind of lands in that third area in the policy and advocacy piece. In 2023, Right to Food partnered with six organizations across the country in BC, the Prairies, Ontario, Quebec, Atlantic Canada, and the North. The goal of this was to bring local organizations together to strengthen our collective advocacy through a series of regional advocacy networks. And my role really focuses on building relationships with organizations across BC, understanding what their strengths and challenges are, and creating opportunities to collaborate. My understanding is that the name Community Food Centers Canada was great at speaking to the organizations and that sort of that first point that I talked about the community food centers themselves that run food programs and grow food and that kind of thing, but it didn't speak to the policy direction that Right to Food wants to move in and wants to center. So we wanted to draw more attention to the advocacy component of Right to Food's work. And so that is sort of at the core of the name change.
In several of our conversations, universal basic income has been referenced as a way to support a more equitable and sustainable food system for both eaters and producers. Can you give a brief overview of what UBI is?
Most of what I know comes from groups like Basic Income Canada and Basic Income BC, who've been researching and advocating on this for years. So I'm going to lean on their definitions. But Basic Income Canada defines basic income as something like an unconditional cash transfer from government to individuals to enable everyone to meet their basic needs and participate in society, regardless of their work status. And I think it can be really confusing when talking about basic income because everyone sort of understands the concept, but the way in which it's implemented sort of differs a lot. So there are two major models that people refer to when they talk about basic income. The first is a universal model, and I think this is ultimately the core of what people talk about when they talk about UBI. It provides the same dollar amount to every person, regardless of their other income. And often in this model, those that have higher sources of income elsewhere, the income that they receive through the government, through the basic income program, might be taxed back to make up for the payment. So it will go out to them, but it might be clawed back by the government to sort of balance out the system. So that's my understanding of one model. And the second model is, I think it's also called the guarantee model. So in this model, your other income that you receive through your job or elsewhere is considered upfront. And so if that income is low, you receive the full amount of the basic income program. But as your income rises, the benefit gradually decreases. And at a certain point, you'll pass the income threshold and make enough money where you won't receive any of the benefit. I think a lot of benefits in Canada already work this way. The seniors benefit and the Canada child benefit and the Ontario basic income pilot use this model as well. It gets at the income piece and the poverty piece, which is one of the main root causes of food insecurity.
I think sometimes even getting to that feels very ideal. So are there certain policies and steps that say Right to Food Canada and the network of partners are advocating for at this point that move us forward? And I'm just curious, there have been the recent announcements related to automatic tax filling. Is that a step towards making this more possible?
It can feel really overwhelming to pick one or two policy ideas here and there to advocate for when food insecurity is so interconnected to so many different systems like housing and income and climate change and Indigenous rights and food sovereignty. There's so much that anyone can focus on. How do you decide where to put your limited energy? As a coalition or network, I think it's really important to put parameters around your main advocacy goals and decide, you know, what policy agenda is realistic for your capacity and aligned with your values. So the Regional Networks Project through Right to Food was launched to primarily focus on advancing systemic changes that tackle the root causes of food insecurity. Like, we know that we have enough food to feed everyone, but the affordability and the access of that food is the thing that creates food insecurity. So we wanted to get at that when deciding what advocacy priorities to focus on. We also take a federal approach because it's a national crisis and it does require a coordinated national response and pressure put on the federal government. And that's also the jurisdiction of the government that all of our Right to Food partners have in common. It's a way for all of us to work towards a collective goal that really impacts everyone in the network. And another parameter is that we wanted to center people aged 18 to 64 in our advocacy efforts because currently, this is a group that experiences disproportionate levels of food insecurity, but receives very little targeted support. There's a lot of stigma and stereotypes and ableism and outdated notions about the labor market that shape public opinion and government policies. And so we saw a gap in advocacy for folks in this age range. So this is the focus that shaped the approach that we're currently taking to address food insecurity at the national level. And that boils down to three main policy priorities. The first one is a dignified income floor. Income is one of the strongest predictors of food insecurity. And we see a dignified income floor as the means to ensuring that everyone has enough to meet their basic needs through stronger targeted income supports. So this approach builds on supports that already work and exist and enhances them by expanding benefits and accessibility. And it also opens the door for new initiatives like a groceries and essentials benefit to fill urgent gaps. So it can be difficult for any policy to be seen as a quote unquote quick win, especially with the government right now that is choosing to make the focus of this budget, you know, austerity and saving money and making sacrifices. And that's, you know, a lot of the language that's being used around this budget. So it's difficult to envision any new income policy as being a quick win, but we've seen MPs be open to this policy idea and adding additional benefits and strengthening that income floor. So that's where we feel there is momentum to put our energy right now. So that's one of our main policy priorities. The second one really focuses on advancing Indigenous food sovereignty. We know Indigenous peoples experience some of the highest rates of food insecurity, and that has its roots in historical and ongoing colonial laws and practices. There's an Indigenous network that works with Right to Food and Indigenous-led community food centers that are sort of driving this work. We've heard time and again that food security can't be solely defined by individual income in the context of Indigenous communities and Indigenous food sovereignty. The solutions must go beyond government cash transfers and take on those root causes. And that looks like collective access to land and food and governance, which are essential components of Indigenous health and security. And those aren't an optional supplement to income-based policy. It's a vital part of nation-to-nation relationships and reconciliation. So Right to Food has this ongoing campaign right now called Seeds of Sovereignty, developed in partnership with the Indigenous Network and Indigenous-led CFCs who have built on them and put them into 6 concrete policy suggestions, like investing in and protecting Indigenous food systems and creating paid roles for hunters and knowledge keepers who are upholding Indigenous ways of being, doing, and harvesting. And I just mentioned this because the report and the policy asks are coming out very soon, and it'll be on Right to Food's website. And then the third policy priority is strong public infrastructure. So acknowledging that along with income and Indigenous food sovereignty, we support strong public systems and encourage the federal government to invest in childcare, housing, pharmacare, dental care, and other community supports that lower costs for households. These investments, you know, like really reduce pressures for workers and people that are living on low and fixed incomes and protect against financial shocks. And this framing of reducing cost of living really resonates with a lot of the people that I work with who have lived and living experiences of food insecurity and poverty. That's a big constant pressure that's felt. And so when they're using limited time and resources to engage in advocacy, that emerges as a priority for them. That's where we want to put in our time and our energy, is focusing on how can we bring that cost of living down so that public infrastructure plays a really, really big role in bringing that cost of living down. So that's a big priority as well. So those are the 3 main priorities. And just noting for a second, the announcement from Prime Minister Carney on automatic tax filing for low-income Canadians, we definitely welcome it as a sign of progress. And, you know, that can be a huge point of stress and additional time, particularly for people in precarious and low paid employment situations. So it will definitely help, but we don't feel it's enough. And we'll continue to like ask for more. When we talk to the federal government about our policy priorities, we don't really feel like it gets at that root cause piece. So we'll turn the attention back to the other 3 priorities that we have.
You are listening to Tempest in a Stockpot. I'm Christine Bruce.
And I'm Brenda Barrett.
In the first half of this episode, we discussed the many inequities of our accepted charity model in Canada with Jordan Faltitude of Gordon Neighbourhood House in Vancouver. In her role as policy analyst, Jordan partners with the organization Right to Food, who are, like many organizations around the world, lobbying hard to implement a universal basic income that would provide equity for anyone experiencing food insecurity. I introduced this episode under the title Challenging the Charity Model, but at this stage I'm going to add the subtitle The Necessities of a Dignified Life. Our conversation with Jordan is about to turn into an extended call to action, where we can all work to ensure our entire community can access those very necessities that make life dignified. Everyone in Canada would benefit in some way if a universal basic income were implemented, and if we all lobby for it, think how much more equitable society would become.
How would you describe the food system you would want to eat from, or you hope to eat from?
I want to eat from a food system that is grounded in dignity and abundance and justice. One where access to food isn't determined by income or geography or identity, but it's just a condition of being human. Food that's grown and shared in ways that honors the land and the people who care for it. It means that farmers and food workers are paid fairly and treated with respect and are able to access the things that they need to do that work, like healthcare. It means communities have agency in shaping their food futures, and that there's so many different ways that can look like, but from growing their food, urban gardens, all the way up to Indigenous food sovereignty. And it's a system where the connection piece, food brings us together. It's not just to survive, but it's a point of joy and connection and belonging. And it's ultimately one that reflects the reality that like food is a right, and we need to talk about it as such and treat it as such. It is a right. It is not a privilege. My dream food system is one where everyone has what they need to nourish themselves and their communities. And, you know, one where we don't feel alone and isolated. That's the food system that I want to eat from.
As an individual citizen, eater, someone who cares but has limited time, it's not my job to be involved in systemic change and policy. What can I do if I think this is what I want to see my politicians, the people I voted for, doing? How can I support this movement? Does it matter to write a letter to the editor? What are the steps that an individual person can take?
And are there things on the personal level that you can be doing in your everyday life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like not just with your politician, but you personally in your community.
Yeah. Like, does it matter if I write a letter? It's everything. Government responds to public opinion. They pass policy that is not necessarily grounded in evidence or the best long-term outcomes or the most efficient use of money. Like, they respond to what people are thinking in the current moment. We're seeing that, I think, a lot in the direction that our immigration policy is taking, that there's this cultural racism that's going on, and scapegoating of immigrants is the root cause of our economic problems that we're experiencing right now, or we see in our day-to-day lives. And our government's passing more restrictive immigration policies, even though that's, you know, we very much know that that has nothing to do with our economic challenges. I hate to use a negative example when talking about this, but it goes to show the impact that public opinion has on policy. We absolutely need to mobilize to write letters, to make noise, to be really, really loud about the things that we believe in and we care about. And I understand that in our capitalist system, we've been isolated in a way and our time is being spent in ways that makes it really difficult to take the time that's needed to engage with these systems. So I think just understanding what your capacity is and engaging however you can. You know, if you want to sign a petition, if you want to sign an open letter, there's even platforms that have been built where you click on the link, you add your name at the end, and it will send a letter to your representative. There are a lot of tools that are making it easier to engage. And so if you really don't have very much time, just a simple Google search and what you're interested in, you will find people doing that work. You will find ways to engage. And if you have more time, then joining groups that are in your communities that are doing this work, meeting up in person, attending protests, being visible in front of government, I think is really, really impactful. Showing the strength in numbers physically and visibly. Speaking to council, I know I've worked with a lot of people who I've never spoken to council and are really, you know, quite intimidated by the act of doing so, but I guarantee you that council cares way, way more about what you have to say than they do about what academics have to say. They care way more about your experience, and your experience is so important in that, such an important piece of that puzzle. So yes, there's lots that can be done, and I definitely encourage people to just read, do a little bit of research, and you'll find it quite easily.
And if this doesn't resonate with you, or you're worried about how other people's rights are going to affect you, maybe having a little bit of a conversation with yourself around the privilege you've had that you've never had to worry about these topics and what you can extend to others, that we're so worried that extending rights to others means it's going to be less for ourselves. And it's so not true.
I have seen so much get done through mobilized mutual aid networks. Like in Victoria, there is a group called Community Food Support that is entirely volunteer run, and they recruit people to source food, put it together, deliver it. Basically, there are people who are mobilizing and taking action and are not waiting for policy to change, because policy can be slow. So in addition to getting involved in advocating for that systemic long-term piece, you can also help by feeding people in your community every day. Especially if you have the privilege and the power and the capacity to do that, it makes such a difference. And we can't forget that in the center of our work is keeping people fed. That's the main thing.
This podcast was generously funded by the Public Health Association of BC. Brenda Barrett is my co-lead and the executive director of the Storytellers Society in Hazelton. Technical production by Christine Bruce. Music by Elijah Larson. Our food expert today was Jordan Bultitude of Gordon Neighborhood House in Vancouver, partnered with the organization Right to Food. For more information on this or any other episode of Tempest in a Stockpot, visit storytellerssociety.org/tempest. Thank you for sitting under a tree and sharing this picnic with us. I'm Christine Bruce, reminding you to stir that pot and put on your lobbying shoes. Oscar Wilde once noted that charity soothes the conscience without disturbing the system that caused the wound, while Primo Levi commented that nothing is more obscene than generosity that depends on suffering to justify it. More equity, please.